morning and welcome to MTSU On the Record at our new time of 8 a.m. Central. I'm Jenna Logue, and we're coming to you from the campus of Middle Tennessee State University in Murfreesboro, Tennessee, and the studios of WMOT-FM. Our guest today is a particularly timely one for the Sunday before Thanksgiving. Mark Bittman writes a column on food and cooking for the New York Times. He is the author of 6 books, including How to Cook Everything and Food Matters. Bittman spoke at the 2009 Tennessee Undergraduate Social Science Symposium on the MTSU campus earlier this month. I started our conversation by asking him why a person who writes a food and cooking column would be speaking at an academic social science symposium.
Earlier this year, I published a book called Food Matters, which is a look at the intersection among overproduction and overconsumption of meat and processed food and global warming and environmental damage and obesity and lifestyle diseases, all that great stuff. And that book's called Food Matters, and it's a book based on my personal experience, but then also on my work as a journalist in the world of food. So yes, I've been writing about food and cooking for a long time, and this is my first foray into, I guess, the social sciences. But it's a natural outgrowth of the work that I've done up until now, because I've always been concerned with how people are eating and what people are eating, and I've always been a booster of home cooking and of honest, straightforward food. And it really appears that a great many of our health problems, at least, if not a fair proportion of even our global warming problems, come from, let's call it, the traditional American diet, or let's call it the misguided typical American diet.
I guess the social science part comes in determining why we eat what we eat. In that vein, to what extent do you think our food choices are the result of corporate manipulation for profit?
Well, look, corporations, to a great extent, to put it, in a word, to a great extent, corporations exist to be profitable. And until someone demonstrates to the big food corporations that producing healthy food can be as profitable as producing what amounts to unhealthy food, they're not going to do it. And I had this argument with a colleague yesterday who said, well, all that has to happen is the food chains have to be shown that it's in their interests to produce so-called healthy food. But it's not in their interests to do that unless so-called healthy food becomes profitable. Right now, it's cheaper, easier, and more profitable to produce and sell. I'm trying not to be too hyperbolic here, to produce and sell food that is not of the greatest benefit to its consumers, which is to say fatty, salty, sweet, overprocessed meat and what amounts to junk food. I mean, junk food is a shorthand term, but it's accurate enough.
I think that you need not produce any statistics or quantifiable data in order to make that case, because just about anyone who goes into a grocery store on a weekly basis and does the shopping for a family knows that the processed food and the snacks are going to cost you less than organic produce, for example. And people wonder why there's so much obesity among the poor and the working poor. Well, that's a large part of it, it seems to me.
Although I'd argue that if people do their own cooking, you can eat real food less expensively than you can eat processed food. But it does take an investment in time. It certainly takes a stove. Which when you're talking about really poor people, you're not always going to find. But for the majority of Americans, and I would say for the vast majority of Americans, it's actually cheaper to buy and make real food than it is to whip together or buy takeout, buy prepared food at the supermarket or buy takeout or eat in fast food chains or eat in restaurants or reheat frozen food or any of the myriad of ways that people are conned into buying stuff that's overpriced and not particularly good. I didn't say that lousy food was inexpensive. I said it was highly profitable.
Well, if you have to make that kind of an investment into investigating and understanding the ways in which you can eat healthy food without spending your very last dime, is the average hectically working person who has a home and children and maybe is working two jobs just to make ends meet, is that person going to have the energy to invest in that kind of knowledge gathering endeavor to start out with?
Well, you know, not to be combative, you're talking about a hypothetical person. I would say I would counter that there are many people in the United States who claim to be too busy to cook but spend a lot of their time or a portion of their time watching other people cook on television. So I would question whether that's a wise use of people's time. Certainly if someone is working 16 or 18 hours a day and using public transportation to get to and from work, there's no argument. That person is going to have a very, very tough time cooking. But that, I don't think that that kind of person represents the vast majority of people in the United States. And as it happens, half the people in the United States are either overweight or obese. And I don't think you can argue that half the people in the United States are working 16 hours a day or 18 hours a day at two jobs, hustling back and forth to work and have no leisure time whatsoever, because I don't think that's the case.
If some states, like I know Alabama has already done it and North Carolina is considering it, implement a what's been called a fat tax, that is to say people above a certain poundage have to pay higher premiums for their health insurance, do you think that that would be a good way for society to try to go about rectifying the problem? Critics of that technique have said it's all stick and no carrot, if you'll pardon the pun. There's no incentive there, but there's a great deal of punishment involved if you don't ante up.
I think I'd agree with the critics that there has to be a carrot as well as a stick, and I would I think I could only be convinced. I'm not a policy person, understand, so that anything that I say in this arena is not as well considered as it would be as I would like it to be if I were a policy person. But I would say that I could be in favor of increased health insurance costs for markedly overweight people if there were also increased health insurance costs for people who take on other risky behavior. And I don't think that's being done. So I certainly wouldn't want to see those kinds of rules put into play unless they were putting into play fairly. I mean, do you raise health care insurance costs for people who ride motorcycles, who smoke cigarettes, who take too many pills, who engage in other risky behavior? It gets to the point where it's ridiculous.
Did you come by your appreciation of healthy food and healthy eating by the way you were raised in the home, or was it something that you learned more as an adult?
Interesting question, and I can answer it honestly because my mother is never going to hear this this broadcast. Seriously, I spent a lot of years when people asked me, you know, how did you start writing about cooking? What was your childhood like? And so on. I spent a lot of years denigrating my mother's cooking, but which quite honestly was not particularly interesting. Nevertheless, in recent years I've come to have a new appreciation for it because my mother did go shopping several times a week. She did buy a piece of fresh meat or fresh fish or whatever almost every day. She started most meals with a salad, albeit with a bottled dressing. There was always a vegetable out there, and I think most importantly is that whether she liked the chore or not, she took very seriously the notion that the four of us, I have a sister, would sit down every night and have a meal together and that she would cook it. And that, in fact, we would all help clean up and set the table and things like that, all except my father, of course, who was excused by dint of being a man in the 1950s. So, So there was a way in which I was trained to think that dinner time was a time that people cooked and ate together. Having said that, it wasn't a time that people particularly cooked and ate good food together, and that I learned about much later when I started to learn about, really when I was in my 20s.
Let's talk about the cultural traditions and bad habits. My mother, for example, God love her, was raised in the Great Depression, and she cooked all of the meat that she always cooked to a fare thee well whenever she cooked, because
very nice.
she was terrified that because they got whatever meat they could during the Depression, and it was usually old and lousy and, you know, could have had maggots in it, and they didn't know what they were getting, that she figured if she just cooked the heck out of it, then there couldn't possibly be anything in there that could kill you. And that's the way she cooked for the rest of her life. She never got out of that habit. She never gained an appreciation for al dente vegetables. She would tell you that the green beans that were crisp were not well cooked. You could put those beans back in there and that sort of thing. Have you run across habits like that, and you've encountered different kinds of ways of cooking and eating lifestyles and talking to people?
Not so much, but, you know, I could see that kind of thinking making a comeback because so many people are phobic about food now. That, you know, it's almost the way in which it makes sense to start cooking things to death. Or that you could see people arguing that it makes sense to cook things to death. Look, I think that our food supply is generally healthy, generally sound. I think that the problem is that too many people are letting too many other people do their cooking for them and do their preparing for them and do their nutritional thinking for them, whereas if you get back to basics and you cook sound, straightforward, single ingredients and use them to make simple, honest meals, you're going to be in pretty good shape most of the time.
How do you feel about what the Europeans call frankenfoods, or genetically developed foods developed through laboratory processes?
Well, I think foods, if you're talking about genetically modified foods...
That's what I mean, yeah.
Yeah. I don't know. It sort of depends what day you ask me. My gut reaction is I don't like them. My more studied reaction is I don't see that they've done anybody any good, including the people who are boosting them, like Monsanto. I mean, they haven't even really been profitable for Monsanto. And at the same time, I'm not sure that it's not just another form of hybridization, that hybridization has certainly not been a bad thing. I will say that patenting seeds and making it difficult for poor farmers to plant crops that they've planted traditionally for thousands of years, I can only see as a crime. But in general, I don't know enough to say what I really think about GMO food, because there are people that I respect who say it's not that harmful, or it's probably not going to wind up being harmful at all. It's not the worst thing in the world, and it could be beneficial. But again, having said that, it has not yet been beneficial. So I just assume energies were put into other things, like figuring out a decent school lunch program.
Down here in the South, the joke goes that the four basic food groups are salt, sugar, flour, and grease. And the southern fried meat and three type of
yeah.
cooking still rules the day. And if you don't put, you know, bacon drippings or something pertaining to pork in all of your vegetables and just about everything else short of ice cream, then you're not cooking it right. And this goes for both whites and African Americans, because country cooking and soul food is essentially the same kind of food.
Right.
So how do we get beyond this cultural, it's either heaven or a trap, depending upon your perspective, I suppose.
This is a tough call, but I think I'd probably rather see people eat a lot of vegetables with bacon grease in them than see them not eat vegetables at all. So maybe the old folks knew something.
And as long as you're eating vegetables, that's okay.
Well, you know, it's not eating a bunch of vegetables with a little or even a lot of bacon grease is still not quite the same kind of meal as eating a 16-ounce steak.
Now, I associate that more with people from the Midwest. In college, I had a dorm mate who was from Illinois, and she said that she just could not get by without having her meat every day, whereas although I was not a vegetarian or a vegan for either health reasons or ethical reasons, I did not think my world would come to an end if somehow I were forced to live on a diet totally of fruits and vegetables and never saw a steak or a chicken or a fish anymore.
The world will not come to an end. I think that veganism is a very tough sell, is going to be a very tough sell in the United States, and I don't see any particular reason to sell it. I think that the problem with our diets is not so much that we eat meat at all and that we eat processed foods at all, but that we eat too much meat and processed foods at the expense of plants. So the average American gets 5% or less of his or her calories from fresh fruits and vegetables. I think that if we were to make an effort to get more like 30, 40, 50% of our calories from fresh fruits and vegetables, we'd be on the whole a great deal healthier, and we could continue to eat meat, processed food, even junk food, just in smaller proportions. I think to the extent that we eat fresh plants, to the extent that we eat plants at the expense of the things that we're eating now, and I don't know whether I mentioned this before or not, but we get as a nation, 7% of our calories from soft drinks. To the extent that we can replace some of those calories with plants, to the extent that we can replace some of the 600 pounds a year of animal products that we eat on average per capita with plants, we are going to be a healthier nation. And by the way, we're going to reduce global warming, because the second largest contributor to global warming in the world is industrially produced livestock. So it's not just selfishness. There are altruistic or not quite so selfish reasons to change our diets also.
And in addition to the environmental bad effects of processing livestock, or livestock, the way we do it in the United States today, it's very inefficient, is it not? I mean, if you were talking about it on a cost-benefit ratio analysis, you're putting out all of this effort and causing all of this pollution in order to get one measly pound of ground round or whatever.
You know, it goes back to where we started, and again, it's a question of profit. It's inefficient. You're right, it's inefficient. It's inefficient if you include the environmental costs of producing food this way. Sadly, the people who are producing and selling food this way are not forced to pay the environmental costs of it. So it becomes incredibly profitable and incredibly efficient, because they're not bearing the true costs of what it takes to raise animals industrially. Were those costs put back on the corporations who are doing confined feeding operations, what are called CAFOs, then they'd have to find a better way, because it's really not profitable if you include all the environmental costs that are being borne mostly by taxpayers.
There, just to cite one example without mentioning the name of the company, I know of this organization that produces a great deal of country ham. And
yes.
And they were cited by state environmental regulators. I don't think the EPA got in on the act, or the USDA or the FDA for that matter, for having these great big old cesspools full of pig poop.
Right.
And the pig poop seeps down into the groundwater, and we have yet to fully assess the impact of that on our drinking water and on our soil.
Yep.
And that, you're familiar with all that sort of thing, I suppose.
I am.
How do you feel about the food processors are now trying for people who don't eat the plants that you say they should eat? They're trying to make processed foods that they say will give you a full serving of fruits and vegetables in every cup or every, few ounces or whatever the amount is. There's a spaghetti sauce that is attempting to make this claim now. I also know of a fruit juice that is attempting to make this claim, and it's not V8. How do you feel about food processors trying to make up for the lack of fruits and vegetables in our diet by claiming that they can just, stick it into something that tastes good and say, here, do this and you won't have to eat fruits and vegetables?
Well, and I feel the same way as I do about brownies that contain spinach, which is, why not just eat the spinach? Or why not just eat an apple? I mean, the fact is that most people like fruit and that most people like many vegetables, if not all vegetables. It's just a matter of making them a part of a daily routine. And to go back to your point from before, which is that, a point we were both hinting at, which is that processed foods are value-added foods. So if I take an apple, a pear, and a carrot, and I grind them up and I call it fruit juice, and I sell it to you in a cute plastic bottle, it costs you much more than if you go buy an apple, a pear, and a carrot. So, if you're interested in saving money, but also if you're interested in fiber, micronutrients, freshness, et cetera, just eat the apple, the pear, and the carrot.
Or how do you feel about buying your own apple, pear, and carrot and sticking it in a blender or a juicer and making your own juice?
There's that too.
Yeah, especially if, say, maybe you're old and you have dentures or your teeth are bad, and you'd rather get it with liquid than solids.
Right.
What got you interested in turning this into a career, in writing about it for others?
There were a couple things. I had written How to Cook Everything Vegetarian, and during the course of doing that, which I'm not a vegetarian. I'm not going to be a vegetarian, but I did think that it was. I do think that the world is moving in a more plant-friendly direction, and I think we should be moving in that direction. So I thought, you can't really call a book How to Cook Everything with Less Meat. So this was the title that made sense. And at the same time, I started to see some of the numbers about industrially produced animal products and global warming. And at the same time, I started to recognize that the quality of food, but especially the quality of animal products, had really declined precipitously in the 30 years since I started writing about food. And finally, I had a series of personal health problems that that basically I was able to remedy by cutting way, way back on my consumption of meat and other animal products and processed foods. And I had developed this diet that I mockingly or self-deprecatingly called vegan until 6, because I basically eat as a very strict vegan would until 6 o'clock at night, and then I eat pretty much whatever I like. And I found people saying, hey, that's a great idea, maybe I'll try that. So thus was born Food Matters, which is the story of all of those things, my personal story, the story about, as I said at the top, the story of the intersections among global warming and obesity and lifestyle diseases and overproduction and overconsumption of meat. And,
When you went on vegan until 6, as you put it, how long was it before you started feeling better or seeing beneficial results for your health?
A month. I mean, I started feeling better right away, but what does feeling better mean? I didn't feel that bad to begin with, so... it's like when you exercise, people say, do you feel better? I don't know if I feel better. I felt fine before. So there's a little bit of that. But a month after I started eating that way, I had better blood numbers. I had a couple of symptoms had gone away, and I had lost 15 pounds in a pant size. And a month after that, I'd lost another 15 pounds in another pant size. So... a doctor had once advised me to lose 15% of my body weight, and I thought that was would be quite a challenge. But over 2 months, I lost very nearly 15% of my body weight, and within another month, I'd lost 35 pounds out of 215. So that is almost precisely 15%, and it wasn't that hard. And that was 3 years ago, and can't say I've gotten skinnier since then, but I haven't gained any of it back either.
Are you a good cook?
That's a very nice question. Thank you. I am a good cook. I am not a chef. I am not a fabulous cook. Some people think I'm overly modest, but I know a lot of really, really good cooks, and I appreciate the hard work they put into things. I am a efficient, decent cook, but I think I'm the kind of cook that many, many people could aspire to be without a whole hell of a lot of work.
How does keeping kosher compare nutritionally with other types of diets?
I don't think you can make that question because I don't think you can answer that question because you can be kosher and a vegan, you can be kosher and a vegetarian, you can be kosher and someone who eats meat six times a day. So it's not a specific enough question, I don't think.
You'd have to have a specific kind of diet that happens to be kosher.
I have to know what this kosher person's eating. It doesn't matter whether the food's kosher or not. It matters what they're eating.
Okay. Why is organic produce?
I mean, it's the same. Let me just say this: it's the same question. If you're going to ask me the same question about organic, I'll give you the same answer. Because if you say to me, "How does an organic diet affect people's health?" I would argue that it doesn't. It depends what they're eating. I would argue that the healthy diet, the concern that people should be having is the proportion of plants to everything else in their diets, and that the higher ratio of plants in your diet, the better your diet is, and that is a far more important question than whether you're eating organically or not.
Well, actually, that wasn't what I was going
okay.
to ask.
I apologize.
That's okay. What I was going to ask is, why is organic produce more expensive than non-organic produce at the supermarket?
I think it's more labor-intensive. I think the fertilizer is more expensive because it's not made out of chemicals. It's made out of real ingredients. I think that getting the certification and returning the land to an organic state is an expensive process, and I think people have to, you know, consumers have to bear that cost. Again, if it were profitable for the big food companies to sell a lot of organic food, they would, and organic food would probably be somewhat less expensive. Whether it would be truly organic or not is another question. But I think right now the brunt of the costs of organic food are borne by consumers. It may not be all that profitable for the people who are selling it, but it sure is expensive for the people who are buying it.
Do you think that you necessarily get better quality fruits and vegetables at farmers markets than you do at the corporate chain supermarkets?
Necessarily, no, but in general, yes. Or I certainly think you can. Certainly here in New York, you do.
Do you shop for meats the same way? Because we're not accustomed, really, except in the urban areas, to seeing butcher shops down here or fresh fish markets.
Yeah, we're not accustomed to seeing butcher shops much up here anymore either. You can find them. Look, I'd rather buy my food as close to the source as possible, and I think given a choice, so would everybody else. But that's really not the way we shop, and it's not the way we live. People do their shopping in supermarkets. Again, I think the primary question is, what is it you're buying? It's not the quality is, of course, important, but we are so used to thinking about, is this the best possible version of this thing, that we forget that an organic Cheez-It or an organic potato chip or an organic chocolate bar is still not something you need to live, and it's probably worse for your health than better. So, you know, a friend of mine likes to say organic junk food is still junk food. The point is that supermarket plants are still plants, and they are the foods that we should be eating in preference to other foods in the supermarket.
Our thanks to Mark Bittman of the New York Times for being our guest today on MTSU on the Record. I'm Jenna Logue, and I wish you a truly happy and safe Thanksgiving holiday. Please join us again at 8 a.m. Central Time next Sunday. In the meantime, don't forget you can download the podcast at your leisure at mtsunews.com, and we're available on iTunes.